tonight on Arena. We'll be talking about Stephen King's novel Carrie, published 50 years ago, and Lurleen, William Vincent Wallace's opera, is up for discussion. But first, the 2024 Summer Olympics start this Friday in Paris. Since 1924, Ireland has participated at 22 Summer Games and 8 Winter Olympics. We're all familiar with the heroes of Team Ireland's Olympic history since the gold medal was won by Dr. Pat O'Callaghan in hammer throwing in 1928 in Amsterdam. But you mightn't be as familiar with the artworks that represented Ireland at the Olympics. In its early years, the Olympic Games had categories for painting, sculpture, music, literature and architecture. And Ireland had some successes in those arts categories. To tell us more about the mostly forgotten art competitions and the Irish artists who brought home medals at the time, I'm joined by Siobhan Doyle, author and curator at the National Museum of Ireland. Siobhan, it's going to come as news to a lot of people listening to us right now that this was something that happened and that Olympic medals were given for works of art.
Yes, we associate the Olympic Games so much with the athletic and the sporting side of things. But we have to remember that in its earliest years, the Olympics were very much a cultural celebration, so not just sporting. And the arts categories that you just mentioned were a huge part of that.
And Ireland did fairly okay.
We did. Our first medal for Ireland as an independent nation came 100 years ago in 1924 by renowned artist Jack B. Yeats, and that was for his painting Liffey Swim, which many people may be familiar with because it has since been acquired by the National Gallery of Ireland. It's on public display. It's one of those paintings that would often come up in top 10s or top 100s of Ireland's most loved paintings, and people would certainly recognise it.
Yeah, I think people, if they don't necessarily know the title, would absolutely recognise the image if they saw it somewhere, even just from all of those years that it spent on the front of the telephone directory. I'm going to go to that in a minute. I want to scroll back ever so slightly to the beginning of the modern games and the founders, and about how particularly Baron Pierre de Coubertin, who was responsible for starting the modern Olympics back in the 1890s, he saw the art competition as being integral to this.
Absolutely. He was an arts person himself. His family were artists. He was big into literature and culture, and he wanted that to become an integral part of the Olympic Games. The first modern Olympic Games were in 1896, but the arts categories didn't start until 1912. They were a little bit corrupt in that he asked all the entrants to post their entries to him in his home. He was the judge. He entered his own literature, and what do you know? He won the gold medal for literature in 1912.
That's a very Father Ted moment.
Yeah,
right there.
Exactly. So I suppose with sports is a little bit easier in that you get the medal by who jumps the highest, who goes the fastest. But with the arts categories, it's subjective, it's the critical eye. So there's a bit more room for corruption there.
Particularly when there's only one critical eye throwing his eye over everything.
Now, it did change. He did get a few more opinions in a couple of years later, but he made sure that he got the medal first.
The arts competitions, were they open to amateurs only as well in the same way that the athletics competitions were?
No, professionals were welcome to enter as well. And I suppose that brought about its own controversy because it wasn't necessarily a level playing field. And with the first few years, the winners were mainly locals. Wherever the games were being held, the winners were usually from that city or that country. So there's a little bit of bias there too.
Did there have to be specific themes? Were they chosen from games to games? How did that work?
So all of the entrants for the arts categories had to be inspired by sport. That was one of the criteria. The other criteria was that they couldn't have been performed anywhere. The poetry or the music couldn't be performed anywhere. The artworks couldn't be exhibited anywhere. And we have to admit, Ireland bent the rules a little bit. Another one of our medal winners for Ireland in 1924 was Oliver St. John Gogarty for his piece of literature called Ode to the Tailteann Games. And the Tailteann Games also took place in 1924. That was Ireland's answer to the Olympic Games. And it took place a couple of weeks after the Olympics in Paris, in Dublin. But his poem was published to coincide with the Tailteann Games. It was commissioned by the Irish government, and it was printed in pamphlets and in booklets for the Tailteann Games. So it's likely that it wasn't such a secret before he entered in the Olympics. But there you go.
I'd say that sounds technically like it being in the spirit of some things that might have happened in the Olympic Games across the decades.
Exactly.
The format of the arts competitions, I've seen you write about this. You said that it didn't always work. It wasn't always quite right.
Yes. Again, it's kind of back to the judging. If the judges felt that the entries weren't strong enough, they weren't good enough, sometimes they wouldn't give a medal at all. Sometimes they wouldn't give a gold medal, they'd only give silver and bronze, and sometimes they just ignored the categories altogether. And something that's difficult for researchers like me writing about this subject is that there's not very good archives about them. The documentation is very slack, so it's extremely difficult to read between the lines of the winners, the entrants, and what actually happened.
Tell me a little bit about some of the other Irish competitors across the years in these particular competitions.
Yeah, there's been some household names. Sean Keating, he entered his painting, The Tipperary Hurler, another one that many people will be familiar with. That's in the collection of the Hugh Lane. Mainey Jealous, as we mentioned, Jack B. Yeats, and many other mostly professional Irish artists threw their name into the hat. But our last medal came in 1948 by a woman called Letitia Hamilton. She painted the Meath point-to-point races, and that was the last year of the arts categories. They were moved after that, but she won bronze, and we don't know where the medal is, and we don't know where the painting is.
Yeah, because the archiving of quite a lot of this, it was very different than the information that still exists to this day for people who won in the athletics categories across the course of the years. There are a lot of empty spaces.
Yeah, I suppose it just goes to show that the arts categories weren't regarded by everyone as important as the sports ones. So there's things like the artists are given incorrect names in the archives, or the artist titles are given incorrect names. So it's extremely difficult and a real shame. But there's other ways. It's not just the official Olympics archives. We have a phenomenal database called the Irish Newspaper Archives, which is digital versions of the Irish newspapers across the years. And if you type in the names of Jack B. Yeats Olympics, you'll think that you'd get loads of results. You don't. At the time in 1924, when he did win, there was only a really small corner of a newspaper dedicated to the announcement that he won his medal. So people didn't even blink an eye at the time, to be honest.
Why did you think that was?
I suppose the main focus of the Olympics is sports, and it probably always will be. And I guess for the artist, or for the Irish artist, certainly, it was only a small footnote in their career. And when you compare Jack B. Yeats and Oliver St. John Gogarty to other winners, they weren't as celebrated in their own nation. The Jan Jacobi is the artist that won gold when Jack B. Yeats won silver. And when he got back to Luxembourg, he was inundated with work, with offers. To this day, there's stadiums and streets named after him. His paintings at the time were on postage stamps. So he got a real celebration when he got home, and our guys didn't.
Did at the very least the likes of Gogarty and Yeats get a podium position at the ceremony themselves? They were handed their medals. How the, I'm guessing from the look on your face that's not how that worked at all.
No, it was a very very deflated way of being awarded an Olympic medal, in that they got notified by post. So there was no podium, there was no handing over the medal, there was no facing the flag, national anthem or anything like that. They were notified by post, and I'm sure that's how their medals arrived as well.
So moving on ever so slightly, there's no Olympics in 1940 and 1944, obviously because of the war. The Olympics then happen in 1948 in London. What happened to the art section then?
So the art section was displayed in the Victoria and Albert Museum. So it went out with a bang. But what happened was Pierre de Coubertin wasn't the chair of the Olympic Council anymore, and the new chair wasn't as keen on the arts categories. And they didn't make their way to the 1952 Games. Instead, the arts categories weren't competitions. They were kind of a sideline, a sideshow, in that there was a cultural programme to coincide with the Games rather than them having their own space within the Games themselves. And that cultural programme is still there today with music and dance and celebration. And we see a lot of it in the opening and closing ceremonies, but there's no medals anymore.
Do you think the advent of the oncoming visual and television era and the Olympics starting to make a move into that as the 1950s went on, that that had something to do with them falling out of favour?
Definitely. There's no jeopardy in an art competition. There's no first to the finish line, or, you know, it's not terribly exciting for viewers at home. So, as you said, with the advent of TV and radio, the arts categories just didn't fit into that programme.
I want to go back just maybe briefly to Letitia Hamilton again, and to the fact that her painting, there's no real knowledge of where it is or where it ended up, or it could be anywhere in the world. It may have been destroyed, it may be in a private collection somewhere.
Yeah, and that's kind of the worry. I've only seen sketches of it. I haven't seen what it actually looks like, in that she made, a lot of artists would have made reproductions or a number of versions of it. But the version that won the 1948 bronze medal for Ireland at the Olympics is untraceable. It's believed that it may be in a private collection in the USA, but my fear as a historian is that it's just hanging up in someone's house and they don't know the significance of it. But we don't have a good visual documentation of it, so it may never be found.
On the off chance you have a painting hanging somewhere in your house that looks a little bit like a point-to-point race at some point in the late 1940s, maybe check with your local historian.
Exactly.
Did we have any more successes after that? Is that the end of Ireland's success at the arts and the Olympics?
Yeah, Letitia was the last one, the bronze medal in 1948. But we had a good run at it.
And there's still a continuing, as you said, it's not anything that involves medals, and there are no podiums, but there's still a kind of cultural element to the Olympics that happens even to this day.
Yeah, there is, and like the design and the visual part of the Olympics is really key. So things like the mascots, the designs of the uniforms, there's months and years of work that go into that, because the visuals and the design and the artistic side of it really do have an impact, even if they don't have their own competitions anymore. So I suppose artists and designers are still very much involved in the Olympics, massively, but it's in the background.
As a historian, and it's obviously something you're very passionate about, do you think there's anything that can be done to fill in that gap in the historical record with regards to all of the potential information that's missing, or are they gone? Are they lost to time?
They're not lost, but there are things like digitization of archives. I visited the Olympics Museum in Lausanne in Switzerland earlier this year, and it's quite the trek from Dublin. So things like digitization and online collections and making things more accessible for people would be a start anyway. And I suppose in present day terms, I suppose we can do a bit more to support local artists and local designers and give them a platform every 4 years when the Olympics come around.
Are you heading to the Olympics yourself?
I am indeed, yeah.
Look at you.
Yeah, for my first time, very excited. So I'm going to see athletics and the men's soccer final. So hopefully I'll be there in the Stade de France when Ireland take home a few medals.
We'll all be keeping our collective fingers crossed over the space of the next few weeks for anything, pretty much. Thanks a million for joining us, Siobhan Doyle. Cheers.
Thank you.
50 years ago, Stephen King's first novel, Carrie, became a bestseller. He spent the last half century unsettling all of us, me particularly, and has created some of literature's most iconic characters. Carrie changed horror fiction forever. I'm joined now in studio by a man terrified by Stephen King at a young age and who's been a fan ever since, Paul Markey, the writer for RTE Culture and projectionist at the Irish Film Institute. Welcome to the programme, Paul.
How are you doing?
I'm going to start with Carrie. 50 years since its publication in 1974, it completely changed Stephen King's life. Maybe the story of how he came to write the novel, though, is a great one.
Yeah, I mean, I always find it fascinating. Like, it's the constant question that artists get, where do you get your ideas? And in the case of Carrie, two completely separate ideas just met in his head. I mean, as a writer, you balance a lot of inspiration. And his brother was working as a janitor, and he went one evening to help him, and he happened to be washing out the women's locker room. And Stephen King had never been in a women's locker room. And he asked his brother, "What's that machine over there?" And his brother said, "Well, that's a tampon machine." And so it was a completely alien world for him, and it burnt into his brain. And that floated around for a while. And then one day it connected with an article he read a couple of years before about telekinesis, which suggested that if it did exist, it would be in adolescent females. And he said, just before he'd even finished remembering that thought, it clicked with the experience in the locker room. And that was the inception moment. Initially, now, he tried to write it as a short story, and he got about four pages in before he thought, no, this is a novel, but what do I know about Planet Female, as he put it? So he threw it in the bin. And luckily, his wife, Tabitha, was emptying out the waste paper basket and opened up the pages and read them. And she said to him, you have something here. I want to know what happens next, which is the statement you want to hear from everybody. But from your partner, who's your first reader, that's like the real encouragement you need. But he was like, do I dare write about the female point of view? And she said, don't worry about that. I will help you there. I'll keep it ringing true. And so he went ahead and gave it a go, and he did his first draft in about 3 months, which is usually how he still works today. He gets 3 months in, he gets his first draft done. And he sent it out. He had written three books before this now, but they'd never been published. But he submitted this one and continued his career as an English teacher and working in a laundry, which he did on the side, while Tabitha worked in Dunkin' Donuts. And he kind of, as he said, forgot about it because he was so busy. And he couldn't afford a telephone. So when he got a call from in the school from his wife, he thought, like, this is some serious, I don't know what she's going to say here, but this is an emergency.
We have a moment here, a clip of Stephen King talking about when he first heard that Carrie had sold as a hardcover.
We didn't have a phone, and I got a message over the intercom. I was in the teacher's room, and it was, Stephen King, please come to the office. You have an urgent call from your wife. And I knew going up that either a kid had broken his leg or I sold the book. And it was the book. The editor from Doubleday had sent a telegram. Sent a telegram, yeah.
Which said, do you still have it, by the way?
It said, congratulations, Carrie, officially a Doubleday book, advance $2,500, the future lies ahead, love, Bill.
And that was a life-changing amount of money in those days.
Well, yeah, initially, I mean, it's about 17 grand when I looked it up in today's money, $17,000. And so his wife thought, well, can you write full time? He said, well, no, we have all the kids. And, so he signed up for another year of teaching. And he let it lie. And then the sequel to that story is he got a phone call because now he could afford a telephone, which is the first thing he bought with the initial money. Because the way the book business was then, I mean, the real money was in the paperbacks. You got your foot in the door with a hardcover, and that was at the book clubs and Reader's Digest, and that really got your name out there. And based on the reaction to that, then they possibly Doubleday could sell the paperback rights. And sure enough, he got Bill Thompson, his friend at Doubleday, said to him, when he picked the phone up, he said, are you sitting down? He said, should I be? And he said, we've sold the paperback rights to Signet for Kerry for $400,000, which is, doing the calculations, is 2.8 million in today's money, which is, that's now the life changing. That's when both him and his wife became full-time writers. Like, even with 50% of that was going to Doubleday, but that still was amazing.
For a lot of people, their way into Kerry was probably the movie, which came relatively soon afterwards.
Yeah, a couple of years later, the paperback, you know, went down like gangbusters across America, as you can imagine, and the movie rights were snapped up. And Brian De Palma ended up with the chores of directing the movie, and it was a sensation. Huge success, cost 10 million and made like nearly 200 million at the box office at the time in today's money. And got Oscar nominations for both the actresses in the leads in the movie.
Yeah, we have a little something from it here. This is Sissy Spacek as Carrie asking her mother, Margaret White, played by the great Piper Laurie, permission to go to the prom.
I've been invited to the prom.
Prom?
Yeah, the senior prom. You know, everybody's going.
It's that teacher that called, wasn't it?
Please see that I'm not like you, Mom. I'm funny. I mean, all the kids think I'm funny. I don't want to be. I want to be normal. I want to start to try and be a whole person before it's too late for me to... His name's Tommy Ross, and he's a very nice boy, Mom.
No.
And he promised to stop him and
maybe
you can afford him. And my minute, Mom, I've accepted, Mama.
No, no, no.
I've accepted, Mama. I've accepted.
Still makes me feel strange even to this
time. Yeah, even as an audio, it's quite scary. I mean, by the time Kerry was a hit to cinemas, Salem's Lot now was in hardcover, and that was transformative. So he had a hit movie, and now Salem's Lot now became a bestseller, both in paperback and in hardcover, and was now adapted for the television because it lent itself. It was more a sprawling story, multi-character story. So it lent itself to a TV adaption. And this is when I encountered him as a younger man, because it was broadcast initially on BBC, and then it was repeated on RTE some months later. For, like I said, the rest of the country got to see it. If you live near the coast, you can pick up BBC. Mm. And it was, for me, I'd loved horror. You know, even at that point, I was only 10, but I'd watched all the Universal Monster movies. I mean, I was even allowed to watch the Hammer films because they were always on the BBC Two late at night. But I'd never seen anything like this. And because this was contemporary, and this was, to be honest, vile and quite terrifying, because there's nothing remotely romantic or psychosexual about the vampirism in Salem's Lot. It's just it's just purely awful. And I remember my school friend and I, Mark Battle, and he lived over a chemist in Santry, and we're having a sleepover, and we had seen it when it was on BBC, so we knew what we were in for, but we were still debating, will we watch it again? And it was just the you know, Kurt Barlow, who's the vampire in it, who has little to say in the book and has nothing to say in the TV adaption, but is absolutely horrific. The way he bursts on screen.
I'll be honest with you, I think it is one of the very few Stephen King things that's ended up on screen in one form or another that I've never seen. Now, we have a clip from it here. It's Father Callan, who's played by James Gallery, coming to the Petrie household, and he's questioning the son, Mark, about his nightmares that he's been having about his dead friend. Or are they really nightmares?
He's always been preoccupied with them, and it's not healthy.
Let's not make those judgments now. Mark, you're sure it wasn't a dream?
It wasn't a dream. It was Danny Glick.
Nightmares seem real.
His subconscious fear made Danny seem real to him.
And they were very close friends.
Okay.
Yeah. My thought is that despite all of this, like any sensible human being, you still came back for more.
Yes, because, you know, it's primal being scared. I mean, even though, I mean, I distinctly remember having nightmares about Kurt Barlow, but it just kept me watching more horror films. And I really, I give him the credit of constantly sucking me in all the time to these stories.
We're kind of in and around about the early 1980s here now at this point, right? And that's Pet Sematary era?
Yeah, well, by the time Salem's Lot was broadcast, I mean, it took 2 years for it to be shown over here. The Shining had come out. So he was, Stanley Kubrick had adapted his book, which I think it came out a couple of years before that. So he was well established as being a prolific writer in books, now television and movies now. So yeah, Pet Sematary was the one that came in the mid-80s, which was another one which gripped the public. I distinctly have memories of all the posters up in Easton's and O'Connell Street with the cover on it, because it was the height of you know, paperback covers, horror paperback covers in the 80s, their own thing. They're just beautiful pieces of work. And that was another one that if you look closer, you realise what you were looking at. It was deceptive from far away. But it was a universal story, because it's like, what happens to your pet after it dies, and what happens if you bury it here? I think it's one of the things that I think this is why he's lasted so long, is why his work doesn't date, is that he's very grounded. It always writes from a very, from the ground up, from personal experience, from people's just trying to get through life and the struggles of that. And he despises plot. And he says he comes up with stories which are, basic idea, and then plants characters in it and then tries to just see what happens and has no clue where it's going to go.
I want to move slightly further along, because I think the first one I ever saw in the cinema that I paid cold hard cash for was Misery. And I know that's quite late on. Do you like Misery?
Misery, yeah. Misery is one of his best. Because essentially it's a two-hander, and hence it's been adapted for stage even. But yeah, that's around his time when he was a raging addict. He had a lot of, like he said, you name it, I was addicted to it at the same time. And so Misery became cocaine, he said. In retrospect, when he finally got his life together, he realized that's what that was. She represented all the addictions that he had. And it's a great read because it's a one against one. It really sucks you in. You really want to see, does this character get out of this situation, because this woman is terrifying, almost effortlessly. The movie adaptation, you could argue it's as good as the book, and in some ways it works better visually, because, for example, there's a horrible scene where in the novel she actually cuts his foot off so he doesn't run away, but in the movie
it's the hobbling scene.
It's the hobbling, yeah, with a sledgehammer, and that's worse, I think.
It would seem unfair not to play a clip from the film, given that we both have such a love of it. Yeah. This is from Misery. Annie, played by the incredible Kathy Bates. She won an Oscar for her role, and rightly so. She finds fault with Paul Sheldon's books. He's played by James Caan.
The swearing, Paul. There, I said it.
Yeah. The profanity bothers you.
It has no nobility.
These are slum kids. I was a slum kid. Everybody talks like that.
They do not. What do you think I say when I go to the feed store in town? Oh, now, Wally, give me a bag of that effing pig feed and 10 pounds of that bitchly cow corn. And in the bank, do I tell Mrs. Bollinger, oh, here's one big bastard of a check. Give me some of your Christing money. There, look there. See what you made me do.
That is due a rewatch.
I mean, absolutely. The use of language there is quite something. But her favourite, I think the most extreme word she used was dirty bird, and that to her was the worst she could get.
Was a big deal. Yeah, yeah. To those who maybe don't necessarily get him, why is Stephen King so extraordinary?
Well, he brings horror to the everyday, to the ordinary. I mean, every age group is represented in his books, and it's unpredictable how his stories play out. I think in recent years, even the newer generation that's come up have discovered It. It was adapted into a hugely successful two-part movie, and I think that sucked in a whole new generation to his work.
That's why everybody is afraid of clowns.
Oh, yeah. And personally, I never found clowns scary. So it kind of, that element of it, it doesn't quite work for me visually. It's easier to digest in the book because you can imagine something that's probably more horrible than they can show in the film, in the movie adaptation. But he's always stayed relevant because he's so grounded. He doesn't try and conceptually write. He just he thinks that these stories, I mean, honestly, he believes these stories already exist. Like a sculptor often says, he's chipping away the pieces and just presenting them to the world.
I want to maybe finish off by playing a little something about Stephen King talking about his own writing process, because he is also an incredibly influential figure for generations of writers. His book on writing is one that keeps being pointed back to in terms of people saying that that this is a great beginning point for you if you think about becoming a writer. I have a clip here we're going to play. It's him in 2014 talking about how he writes.
But I've also always thought of it in terms of there's a little thread, a little red thread that goes into a hole in the baseboard, and you just start to pull it out and you see what's on the other end of it, and sooner or later you get there. For me, the fun of writing novels isn't in the finished product, which I don't care about that much. There's a guy who's looking at my shelf over there. All the books are on the shelf, and to me those are like dead skin, the things that are done. But I love the process. I tell the story to myself, and in a way, when the work is the best work, it's more like being a secretary than it is a creative person. You just sort of take this stuff down.
Paul Markey, it's been brilliant talking to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Take care, man.
William Vincent Wallace was one of Ireland's best-known 19th-century opera composers. His first opera, Maritana, was presented in London in 1845. Others followed, including Lurline, but no modern performances of this opera have taken place. Based on the Lorelei mermaid legend of the Rhine, Lurline is a lyrical work, romantic in style. The cast in July will be led by soprano Rachel Kelly, Portuguese tenor Luís Gomes, British baritone Ashley Riches, and mezzo-soprano Gemma Nivrian. The performance will be conducted by Peter Holas, principal guest conductor of the Hungarian State Opera. I'm joined now by the opera's producer, Una Hunt, and by Peter Holas. You're both very welcome to Arena.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you very much.
Una, I'll start with you. William Vincent Wallace, his story is kind of universal when it comes to Irish artists, insofar as he had to venture further afield to get his music heard by a much wider audience. Australia, the UK, further afield. Tell us a little bit about his story.
Well, he was the most amazing composer, really. He left Ireland in the 1830s to emigrate to Australia when it was still a penal colony. And it would have taken him 4 months to get there. And when he got there, he was extremely famous. He did a lot of concerts. The governor of Australia at the time was also Irish. His name was Burke, and he was from Limerick. And he would have supported him. And he did a lot of concerts. He was a virtuoso on two instruments, on both the piano and the violin. And because of that, he was known in Australia as the Australian Paganini. He stayed in Australia for about 2 years. Then he crossed the Pacific to South America, travelled all through South America, playing Irish music everywhere he went. He got to New York and he played in the inaugural season of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. And this was all happening before he ever wrote a note of opera. It was only after that he came back to London and he wrote his first opera, Maritana, as you mentioned, and then he became an opera composer. So he was a most amazing character. He had incredible life experiences as well. I mean, there's stories about him being on a whaling ship where all the crew were half native and they killed everyone on the ship except for 3 people. And he happened to be lucky enough to be one of the 3. And he had all these amazing stories. And you can imagine when he came back to London, how exciting that was when he was telling all those stories in the the drawing rooms of the aristocracy.
Is it fair to say that when he started writing opera, because he wrote in English, it wasn't necessarily the most fashionable language to have for the libretto of your opera at that time, was it?
Well, certainly English opera was struggling during the 19th century because English opera had traditionally been ballad opera. It was a sort of a lower type of opera, if you like. It wasn't the grand operas that were being done on the continent, in France, in Italy, obviously, in Germany. And there was also this feeling in England, and of course, when you were Irish, you were provincial, basically, in those days too. And there was always also this feeling that, you know, Irish people were really not very talented and not very good at anything as well. So he was sort of up against it. And yet he was very, very, his operas were very, very popular. But he was very much influenced by the grand operas that he was hearing coming from the continent, particularly when Weber came to London. His Oberon was done in London, and that sort of changed the whole face of English opera. It became more in the style of grand opera. And certainly he was blazing a trail in terms of that newer type of opera. And Lurline is definitely a much different type of opera to the usual one that they were hearing in England. Of course, you also had the problem in England that, for instance, Covent Garden was known as the Royal Italian Opera in those days. And they only did opera in Italian. And basically, the public wasn't interested in hearing opera in any other language except in Italian. So these English composers, as we can call them, are in the English language, were very much up against it.
When it comes to Lurline itself, it's quite an unknown opera at this stage.
Absolutely. The last performance was in 1939 in Dublin. And it was done by the Dublin Opera Society, or the Dublin Opera Company. I can't remember which it was. But a lot of bad luck has followed this opera as well, because both the soprano and the mezzo lost their voices at that performance, and they had to speak their roles. They couldn't even sing. And then, of course, we should have been doing this opera 2 years ago. It was cancelled because of COVID at a very late stage in the day. And again, it seems almost as if bad luck has followed the opera.
When the time came when you chose to bring it out of the shadows before 2020, why this? Why Lurline? Why did you choose it?
Well, there was a wonderful CD made of it by Maestro Richard Bonning, who is an Australian conductor, very famous, particularly for opera. And he recorded it. So we were able to hear it for the first time from this CD. And, you know, I was listening to this music and I was thinking, this is fabulous music. You know, I mean, why is this not better known? You know, it can hold its head up beside any composer of the 19th century, of that era, you know. And I truly think that Wallace was a great composer. I'm also a pianist, and I would have known Wallace's piano music. He has a lot of piano music that he wrote. And it's just brilliant music. I love it.
Peter, you had your first rehearsal today for Lurline with the accompaniment from the National Symphony Orchestra. It's not only your first time in Ireland, it's your first time conducting a Wallace score. What was your first impressions today?
First of all, I would like to say that you have a fantastic symphony orchestra here in Ireland. And, you know, for me as a conductor, a first rehearsal is always very, very exciting. It's 20 years ago, I thought that probably later in my career, it will be always probably easier to go to a new orchestra. But it's always a very, very exciting point. It's like a first date. you know, and then you really feel whether how the musicians are responding, and I have to admit it was a very pleasant rehearsal, and they both technically fantastic, and they can really listen and to each other and accompany the singers. So it was a wonderful experience, and you know what? Now we are exploring this opera together. And that's also a big adventure.
Okay, we're going to play something from it in a moment. But Una, tell us the story of Lurline. There are similarities to the Little Mermaid in it. It's kind of a true legend, but then there's a sinister turn to it.
Exactly. It is the Little Mermaid, but it's not Disney's Little Mermaid. Well, there was a story, a very famous story about a water nymph from the Rhine in Germany, and she used to sit up on a rock above the river, and she would sing, and she would lure sailors to their deaths, basically. So she was quite a sinister character. So in a way, the story of this Lurline, she's a nicer person than the Lorelei, I think, because she falls in love with the Count Rudolph, and she wants him to come and live with her under the water. So she gives him a magic ring, and he's actually able to live underwater. But then he decides he wants to go back to the real world, and she gives him all these treasures to bring back with him. And when he goes back, a certain suitor or a certain lady who had been interested in him until she discovered he'd no money, then suddenly got interested in him again. And so she throws the ring back into the Rhine. And as soon as the ring is gone, he has forgotten Lurline. He's forgotten the water nymph. But then he meets her again, and he falls back in love with her again. And sure, then they go to her palace in the deep.
Well, then let's play something from Lurline. This is The Night Winds. Peter, maybe you just give us your reaction to that piece.
Oh, it's such a wonderful surprise for me. I have to admit, before Una asked me to conduct Lurline, I didn't really know the composer, William Wallace. And I just opened the score, and it was so crystal clear. It is like an early German opera for the first sight. It's like Weber, or has a lot of Mendelssohn in it. Also have some Strauss family, Johann Strauss family, kind of buffo music. Some opera finale, which are similar to Donizetti finales, because Wallace conducted a whole season of Italian opera in Mexico City. So you hear all those influences, but in the end, it's a very typical music. So in the end, it's all together, it's William Wallace. And you clearly hear that he knew how music goes, how the music of his time goes. And the orchestration is wonderful. Hector Berlioz talked about William Wallace as a great orchestrator, and you can immediately hear that. And the melodies are stunning and lovely. So it's a really very big surprise for me and a very pleasant surprise.
Una, tell us a little bit about the cast that people will be able to hear if they go along.
Indeed. We have Rachel Kelly first, who is our soprano. Then we have Ashley Riches, who is Reinberg. That would be, he's playing her father. Luis Gomez, who's Count Rudolph, who's the man she falls in love with. Gemini Vrian is Giva. I'm not quite sure if it's Giva or Gaiva, but you can say that name either way. And she is the person that tries to steal Count Rudolph from Lurline. Then we have Thomas D. Hopkinson, who is the gnome, and Rory Dunn, an Irish singer, who is the Baron, and Anna Brady, another Irish singer, Leba, and William Pearson is Wilhelm. So we have a really stellar cast, fabulous cast.
It would seem like a terrible shame not to take something again just really quickly from elsewhere within the opera. This is from Act 3, Scene 2. It's Sweet Spirit, Hear My Prayer. And that's sadly, unfortunately, where we have to finish it for tonight. Una Hunt and Peter Halash, thank you so much for coming in studio and for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
The National Symphony Orchestra Lurline Opera concert performance comes to the National Concert Hall this Friday night, the 26th of July. And you'll find more information at nch.ie. That is it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Barbara Rose Sanwo. James Feeney was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Therese Kelly. John Creedon is next after the news at 8. I'm Rick O'Shea, and I'll see you tomorrow night.